Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Smiley Kaufman for 61. Wow.
I'm Smiley Kaufman, and this is The Smiley Show.
Appreciate everyone joining us. It is once again a late night, Sunday night live show edition of The Smiley Show. I'm Charlie Hume. He's Smiley Kaufman, fresh back from a little beach refresher trip. Love to dig into that a little bit. As we always do, we're going to let some people filter in, kind of hang out, populate the chat, things like that, so we can take questions. And wow, look at this, dude. We've got about 10 comments already. This is amazing. So we are rocking and rolling this week. But Smiley, how are we feeling post-beach trip?
You know what? I don't think I saw a cloud the entire time I was there. It was just perfect. The best time to go to the beach is in May and October. And we had a perfect fall beach trip that was terrific, and got back this evening just in time to order some DoorDash and then watch Jaden Daniels throw a Hail Mary touchdown. It was so sick.
Yes, that was the good side of LSU football this week.
Thank you for mentioning.
Thoughts and prayers to you. Listen, Carolina football won the oldest rivalry in the South, back on the CW again this week. So big week for us in our quest to make the Duke's Mayo Bowl as we send off Mac Brown. So
we're really proud of you guys this year. I mean, maybe not. I'm pretty down on LSU after that loss at A&M. It was a tough scene. It was a game in which, I tell you what, that other quarterback they had in there, Wegman or whatever his name was.
They should have kept him in there because
I liked what I saw from that guy. I would have loved to have seen four quarters of what that guy could have done, because the 99 Madden player they put in at quarterback didn't like anything that he was bringing to the table.
That was very confusing as to why he's not playing. It seemed like he was perfect for what A&M was trying to do on offense, and Wegman was just everything
like,
but that.
It's so. Like we've never seen a running quarterback before and just had no clue what to do. It was a classic case of, you know, everything's going swimmingly and around, and all of a sudden the wind from a storm comes up, and you don't really have it through the first nine holes, but then the wind comes up, storms brewing, or like maybe even nightfall. And then you just start like just forgetting how to be a person, a human being. And that we had 11 of those, all of them forgot how to be a person on the field on defense. And then, we had a quarterback that was seeing more ghosts than what Freeform is showing on TV right now.
That was sick Freeform shout out. Love that. You had a great tweet of just Brian Kelly squatting on the sideline looking at the scoreboard. It's like when you have to make a trip back to the pro shop after the first nine holes to reload on balls. We've all been there squatting down, looking at our bag. I swore I could have packed more golf balls, and I'm out already.
Here's something I was thinking about on the way home is – I've always like wanted to be friends with the head football coach at LSU, and this one's a golf fan. I know Brian Kelly's a golf guy, but I also want to be critical of the LSU football coach. And like, I don't want to become like friends with the coach because I want to be critical. It's kind of like, you know, I'm sure there's plenty of relationships like that, where people just feel like they don't need to be friends in order to just fire off those tweets, you know? And I feel like I'm in need sometimes of just firing off some hot tweets during a football game.
You know, it's so interesting because I was thinking about this and just in the worlds we occupy, where I feel like there are definitely relationships more for you than for me, but still from a show perspective that we kind of want to protect in the golf world. So you don't just want to go around just spraying on everybody. You know, obviously we're going to give our honest opinions on the show. We're not going to hold back, but there are certain things where you think about the way you want to say it because you want to kind of protect relationships. Whereas I feel like in the college football world, like, I don't think any of these guys were beholden to any sort of standard there. So I was watching this game last night and I was trying to decide in my mind, like, which individual do I want to lose more? Brian Kelly or number five on Texas A&M? And I couldn't make the call. I really could not make the call.
There was a lot of hot takes about number five, for sure.
Not a fan.
No, there was not the he wasn't getting a sportsmanship award after that game, a medal for his good works during that game. But hey, I mean, he played with a lot of toughness, a lot of grit. But yeah. Man, it was stop. Once that train started rolling, it was never stopping.
Dude, College Station is like that. Is they get the towels? They get the audio pumping.
Don't get me started about that school, that stadium.
Let's get
not
the
an A&M guy. Not an A&M guy. I don't get it.
It's a cult. To be fair,
the one thing I'll give them credit for is like I don't think I would ever do anything at midnight past the age of 24 with a bunch of people in a stadium. The midnight yell. I can't fathom doing something like that to stay out to do that. So like to get that many people that invested into doing weird cheers. Like I don't get that part of it. The all the stuff that nobody understands, and A&M people are like, no, it's cool. Trust me. Like it's that type of frat party that you show up. It's like, trust me, these are the cool kids. And I don't know. I have A&M friends, not many, but I do have them.
Are there any A&M guys on tour? I was just trying to rack my brain. Like, are we roasting any A&M guys that play on tour right now?
I think Ryan Palmer. I love RP. he's great.
I love this comment.
There's some other guys that are A&M fans. I think like Cameron Champ.
Oh, that's right. That's but correct. Okay, so there are a few.
I don't take him to be like some hardcore A&M guy though. Maybe he is. I don't know.
I feel like it's hard to not be a hardcore A&M guy if you went to A&M, unless you just really was.
Yeah,
not
do you like wear like your ring and stuff? Yeah. That's a thing.
They love it down there. I'll say just to protect you from like continuing to roast A&M people, that this was a very unique sports watching weekend because we watched, golly, what was that? I guess it was Friday nights. There was a few college football games on, but did some college football Friday night and then rolled into game one of the World Series. Freddie Freeman, extra innings, walk off grand slam, shades of Kirk Gibson was one of the sickest.
Were you watching
ever.
It live?
Watching it live. Holding the bat.
Good
up.
For you. Fran and I passed out. I fell asleep on purpose with my glasses on to keep the TV on because I knew if there was a chance that I woke up to the volume of something happening, and it wasn't me that woke up, it was Fran that woke up and said, "Who won?" And so I already had my glasses on ready to go, and I see Freddie Freeman getting interviewed, and it says Dodgers win 1-0, they're up 1-0 in the series. I'm like, Dodgers won, Fran. Great. Turn off the TV, go to bed. Next day, I was like, oh, shoot, he hit a home run. Oh, wait, it was a grand slam. Oh, wait, they were down 3-2, and there was two outs. All of these things. I'm like, wow, I really did miss an incredible, incredible moment. But as you know, the REM cycle is just as important to get that started.
I was stunned I was up that late. I think I figured out that like my one late night every week is Friday. Cause like I try to play golf with the boys that day. I save the weekend for the family. I try to play golf with the boys that day, come back, check in, do bedtime, do everything I need to do with the fam, get Amanda to bed. And then I'm like, all right, I'm going to go out, hang for a little bit. So that's why I was up late watching sports. I probably would have missed it any other night of the week, but that, and then flip the channel right over to Golf Channel. And all of a sudden mm-hmm. watching golf in Japan. Which I think is an appropriate segue here because
hold on.
Okay. All right.
Breck Cherry just commented something. I just got to get off my chest before we get into golf. All he said was, Smiley, please give us the honest mental state with Brian Kelly. And so I think I'm just going to give it to you.
Okay, here we go. I love it. Unfiltered comments. Nothing good happens after 9 p.m.
So, Jaden Daniels, Malik Nabers, and Brian Thomas were on a football team last year.
Mm.
That football team lost three games. If you've seen these three football players in the National Football League, you could argue that they're one of the best players at their positions. Maybe Brian Thomas, I mean, the yards are there. It's how do you lose three games with those three types of dudes? We couldn't be stopped last year, but it was the terrible hires right off the get-go, right when he got to LSU with Matt House. He owes apology to everybody. So it was poor hires on the defensive side of the ball. Now, last year, first off, we couldn't run the ball last year. The only run game that we had was Jaden Daniels. So 2 years in a row now, we cannot run the football. Mm-hmm. And Garrett Musmeyer is forced to have to throw the ball. He threw the ball 50 times, 50% completion rate. And we just refuse to put games away. Like, just have no idea how to put games away. It's the USC game was agonizing. Last night, the A&M game, we should have been up 27-7. And now if they put that guy in, he may have came back and won that game just because how incredible he was. But with all that being said, I just think back to the LSU-Tennessee game. I think about us losing both home openers to Florida State 2 years in a row and then losing to USC this year. I don't know what we do in the offseason, but we just cannot figure it out. Like, we don't know who our best players are. It's like this, we're not putting the best guys on the field and we can't figure it out. And it's so frustrating because it seems so obvious to me as a fan. It took a year and a half, 2 years to get special teams right. We couldn't do anything on special teams the first year. Terrible defensive hires and
tough special teams scene last night as well.
And then last night, like, our special teams were a nightmare. So listen, Ed Orgeron, he won a national championship at LSU. And that's where I draw the line here. And if, like, okay, we've had talent like Joe Burrow, Justin Jefferson, and Ja'Marr Chase. And then you go Jaden Daniels, Malik Nabers, Brian Thomas. It's like, what gives? How does one team go undefeated and one team lose three games? And honestly, we should have potentially lost more games that last year. It was because of Jaden Daniels' comebacks. And that's the bottom line. We could have been a 5-loss team last year, and that's frustrating when you look at the talent that we've been able to put out in the league. So
There's a comment here from the Scratch Golf Show comparing some of the talent that Ohio State's had without winning. I would argue that LSU is the best school of all time of doing less with more. And then, like, Carolina does, like, their JV version of LSU doing less with more. I mean, at least LSU's won some national championships. And you had Joe Burrow there and that whole scene. There, LSU's won stuff in the past. But it does feel like what you're saying is
every true. Coach has won a national championship. Like, the last three coaches we've had. Nick Saban, Les Miles, Ed Orgeron, and Brian Kelly's the next dude. It's like, I mean, is he going to ever get over, like, is he a great football coach? Right now, I think a Notre Dame fan would tell you is like, hey, this is exactly what you should have
this
expected.
This is the Brian Kelly experience.
And so I don't know where I stand right now on it. It's hard.
It's also like, I'm just not a fan of the way you coach some of the kids. It's like, there's just not really, there's not a ton of, I don't know what the right word is for it. And shoot, he's forgotten more about football than I'll ever know. But there's just a lot of times where the vibes just aren't good on those sidelines. And then you look around, you see kind of like some of these newcomers, like what Kurt Cignetti's doing at Indiana and the way he's kind of instilled a culture, like, in the span of one season. And you just wonder what a guy like that could do at a bigger program like an LSU.
Well,
who knows? You know?
The culture thing is not the problem to me. It's the X's and O's sometimes, and it just makes me angry. And then during the game, like, I love Brian Kelly off of the field, but on the field, I don't like how he yells, like, the entire game at, like, the people in his ear, the people on the field, the players. Like, there's no balance in, like, of aggressiveness and and being able to, like, show emotion. It makes hard to root for him on the field because he looks like a tomato every game, just red face, yelling, so mad. And I'm mad too, but like at the same time, there's a way of balancing, like not getting in every player's face and yelling at them, because like they know they screwed up. It's more about, can you get these guys into better situations? I feel like, but I don't know.
Well, that was our it was a good rant. I'm glad we pulled it out of you. I'm glad you got it off your chest. We've got some comments popping off here, Smiley, that are going to kind of take us into the golf this week. Gary talking about how cool it was. Same thing we were talking about. Zozo rolling right out of the World Series to JT and Ricky late night. West Coast primetime. Could not possibly agree more. And so let's get right to it, buddy, because these are your guys. The Spring Breakers. Ricky and JT playing well this week. I mean, we probably got to start at the top of the leaderboard. Nico Echeverria wins his second PGA Tour event. Not like a young guy, you know, but sort of a late bloomer, 30 years old, played at Arkansas, won at Puerto Rico in 2023, and then wins here in the fall in 2024. So just impressions of what Nico did to hold off a lot of big names at the top of that leaderboard.
Yeah, let's start with Nico. Awesome win, right? I don't think anybody saw it coming. If you would have told me he won the Zozo Championship, I would have been absolutely shocked. There's nothing that would have predicted him winning this week. You know, the golf course, from what I saw, it was a course in which he had to be very accurate off the tee. There was some rough off the fairway, narrow fairways. You know, it was soft, which I think maybe was a benefit to him. I'm not sure. But when I looked at his stats, I had an opportunity to watch the fourth round, just kept up with scores, watch highlights the first three rounds. And what Nico was able to do, and you see this a lot of weeks on the PGA Tour, it's the guy who has the really hot round with their putter the first round that is able to get off to a nice start to get themselves on top of the leaderboard. Nico was able to do that with a incredibly hot putter the first round, and if you look at his stats in a whole, just big picture of like what he does, what type of player he is, he's the most like really average player across the board. Like, he's not bad at anything, but he's not necessarily great at anything. So when you try to predict a player like this winning, I think it's like dang near impossible, because when you don't necessarily excel at a, you know, superstar level at any really facet of the game, it makes it, you know, that's why I was saying with Nico, him winning this week was a surprise, because I don't know what he's good at. And it's not that he's not bad at anything. It's just I think I'm still learning about his game, and I think he's still improving in each facet. But you go look at his little chart, it's like there's nothing below or above. It's the most wild stats chart I've ever seen. But the putting was insanely good the first round. He was first in putting, gained like X amount of strokes, much more than everybody else. And then in round two, and this is what carried him the rest of the week, but he had a career day with his irons in the second round. So I think when you look at how did he get in position going into the weekend, hot putter first round, incredible iron play the second round, and then rounds three and four, he was already in a great spot and was just solid across the board. Hit some really nice iron shots, played the par threes well. But when you talk about Nico and his year last year, Charlie, and this is what nobody can understand as a professional golfer being one, is his year winning in Puerto Rico, you know, you earned 300 points. It's an opposite field event. He played 31 times last year and he missed 23 cuts. And at one point he missed 12 cuts in a row. So with that being said, it's, you got to give a man credit, because it ain't easy when you have the highs of winning on the PGA Tour like he did last year, and then majority of lows where you're, you know, booking a flight on Friday or Saturday, going to the next week, trying it all over again. It's not easy, but he was able to make himself do well enough to where he made some cuts at the end of the year to stay inside the top 125, which got him to this year. He's improved. He only missed 12 cuts this year, so he cut that number in half. But really, the only top 10 that he had this year was at the Zurich, and that's playing with another guy. So this win came out of nowhere. It was one where I thought Justin was probably going to chase him down, but hey, you got to give credit to Nico, man. Winning's not easy, and he gritted it out. I think grit would be the way to define that win.
It's such an interesting existence to live as a PGA Tour pro, where you have a 2-year exemption from your win. But and it's almost a similar place that Ricky's in. We're going to talk about Ricky here
in
a second.
Right, that's a good point.
He won at Rocket Mortgage, so he's good through the next season. But he's also in that kind of that ground where you're of course 51 and beyond, or even 75 and beyond, and you're kind of saying, hey, I'd like to make up a little bit of ground. Maybe work my way into that 51 through 60 range for the next thing, but at least kind of move safely inside that top 125 line. That's what Nico Echeverria did this week. He entered the week 130. 13th and is projected to move up to 65th. And just to fill in a little bit of additional detail on what you're talking about, that first round gained 4.32 strokes putting, unbelievably good round on the green. And then in that second round, strokes gained approach, gained 4.42 strokes with his iron game. So just two really, really solid parts of his game on those days. And of course, played well the rest of the tournament. As it turns out, his strongest stat category was approach for the week was plus 2.25. But those 2 days, to your point, really propelled him. And I believe it was back-to-back 64. So, that just kind of puts you in a good spot heading into the weekend.
It was a fun final group to watch too, because when I called it, I think I made it to the 12th hole and then woke up every hour to try to refresh to see if JT won. And I went to bed thinking that it was going to be a Max Grazerman, Justin Thomas battle. I just thought that what I was seeing, it seemed like he was kind of grinding his way, talking about Nico, felt like he was going to have one or two more bogeys in there to kind of play his way out. So was surprised to see him win. Huge congrats to him. But I thought the golf course to me was, first off, you mentioned this to me, talking about the double greens on every hole. When they do those flyovers and they would show the other green too, it's the most bizarre thing in the world. Will you remind me why there's a second green?
I believe it's an agronomy thing. Like I believe and this is where I actually have a lack of knowledge on what that climate is there. But I believe it's either one of two things. It's either so here in North Carolina, there's obviously a time of the year where Bermuda is going to be the better performing grass. And there's a slender part of fall and spring where bent is going to be the better performing grass. I'm actually not sure what grass they have in each of these greens, but that is my assumption, that they have one for a cooler part of the year and one for a warmer part of the year.
I don't know about that. I'm going to fact check you on that.
Please.
That seems like that would be too smart. That would make too much sense, right?
So do you think this could be a very interesting cultural thing. Like, do you think it's on your first guess just that they want to have two radically different pin positions they can change on a day-to-day basis, both greens with the same turf grass in them?
Well, the way I figured was having that second green was maybe, first off, having maybe another option of how a hole could play. So you have a strategy deal with having an extra green, but also having another green allows you to keep the greens more fresh with less traffic on it. That's
okay.
A way in which you can keep the greens more pure. So that was what I was thinking. But the warm grass, cool grass thing, I'm going to go check this out.
Please do, because I just went to the PGA Tour media portal in hopes that I could pull like the greenskeeper. They have like a fact sheet usually for every week.
Is there not one listed? Like a lot of times
there's not one listed for the Zozo. And maybe that's just a product of...
Okay, I'm not going to be able to find it then. I can't get the...
Yeah, I mean, it's something we're going to have to dig into.
We're going to roll with that. Whatever. I'm in for that.
Yeah. Listen, if you guys know...
Gary says Charlie's correct and they only use two greens on one hole this week.
Gary. I'm gonna put his comment up.
Gary, are you able to let us know what the grasses were? Because I just don't know what grasses would be deemed cool and warm weather grasses.
If someone can figure out what the grass types were at, and I hope I'm gonna say this correctly, Accordia Golf Narashino. If someone can figure out what the grasses are for each of those greens and they can put it in the chat, I promise you I will put that comment up here on the stream. So help us out.
It's kind of cool. Are you the one putting these comments up?
I am the one putting these comments up.
And we have like a rolling leaderboard.
We do.
You did this too, huh?
Here, wait, you ready? Gary's got an update.
Okay. All right. I think you and Gary are definitely just in cahoots here when it comes to being on the same team, just a fact checker that doesn't fact check.
I'm loving the input here from Gary. Here, look at this. And I'm going to refresh the leaderboard here. I'm going to flip over to some Zozo notables, some big names in the field this week. Because the guys we got to talk to, the guys we promised we'd talk about, are two of your buddies, JT and Ricky Fowler. And so to me, I mean, I think there are a lot of different directions you could take this. But to me, the story for each of these guys is, I mean, for JT, you know, his, I think just, he's just getting so close. And I think it's, I thought the putting towards the end of the year was really coming on strong. This is another week where a lot of people could limit the fact that he didn't get it done. But I think the fact that he's back in contention at a high leverage tournament like this, it reminds me a lot of, honestly, a conversation we had with, I mean, Cole Morikawa talked about the momentum that this tournament win gave him going to this last year where he played phenomenally well. And, you know, was hard done to not win a PGA Tour event this year, even though he actually did win at East Lake, but just the starting strokes, you know, he didn't actually win the event. So I think that piece for him, and I think for Ricky even talked about this when we had him on the show after his Rocket Mortgage win, where he, you know, had a good result, the Zozo in 2022, and started to gain some confidence at that point that he rolled into 2023, almost wins the US Open, and wins a Rocket Mortgage. And so this week, seeing him, he was second in the field only to Max Grazerman in strokes gained putting with that new lab putter that he's got in the bag. And everyone thinks back to 2023, it was the switch to the Jailbird that kind of got him rolling a little bit, gave him some momentum. Another putter switch this week in the last couple of weeks. And I think that, to me, is, I'm just really curious to hear what you thought and saw from these two guys this week and the way you think that's going to translate going into next year.
Well, let's start first with Ricky. You know, it wasn't a great year for him, right? It was not a good year at all. He, you know, worked his tail off. And sometimes when you're in a rut and you can't figure out, it seemed like to me, he never had rounds in which he was able to make enough birdies, just didn't have enough offense. But for Ricky, it's, to me, anytime he's playing well, it all starts his game. Honestly, if he's putting it well, it just seems like it opens up so much. But the driver too, you know, combining off of the tee and then the putter, I think it just, his iron game just naturally just gets better, because I think he gets a little bit more in tune with shots that he's going to be playing into the greens, whether it's, you know, a difficult par three, just not biting off too much on a shot and realizing what a good score is that day. So for Rick, this whole fall to me has been that. Like, I think he's been able to drive it better. The putter, like you mentioned, has been very improved. So you got to give him credit for making a change in a statistic in which, dude, this guy was he's a top 10 putter over the last decade. Like, that's how good he's been. But in his down years, it's been, you know, I think the driver and the putter both have kind of been off at the same time. And when he's come back, it seems like the putter is the first thing that kind of wakes up the rest of his game. And for whatever reason, that's what I've kind of noted this fall to me, is that, yes, every part of his game is getting better, but he's putting it in play more often. I think he's hitting, you know, a couple more fairways around. He's making a couple more of those putts inside of 10 feet. And as somebody that's played on tour and knows what it's like to be, you know, right around playing good golf, it's cleaning up the, you know, the simple stuff and being good at what you're good at. And I think Ricky's time away from the game after missing out on the playoffs, I think that's a long time to go from, you know, it was his last event, I think was, I could tell you here, right? It was the Open Championship in July, and his next start was in October. So he had a lot of time, obviously, him and Allison welcomed Nelly into the world. But that amount of time and not touching a club, I think, is good for the mind and just reminding yourself, it's like, all right, what was good golf like? What do I need to do? What rat race am I part of right now where I'm just spinning the cycle on the hamster wheel? And getting away from it sometimes is so clutch. And I think it was good timing for him, because the putter, is, you know, Ricky's always put this type of role in the golf ball. When you've played with him, it's hugging the round. And when you give him a putter like this, where a lot of people have, you know, made the switch and they just start making everything, look out, because we saw with the Gerald Bird, now the Lab.
I mean, a tinkerer, sicko tinkerer over here. I think I need to add another one to my collection, man. I think I need to figure out. I have the Lab broomstick, but I think I need the Lab spaceship satellite, you know, disc, whatever he has. I need to think to add that to the rotation here in the office. Another club he's got in the bag of late. Little mini driver, 13.5-degree mini driver. I know we kind of texted about that a little bit.
Let's get into that, right? Yeah. Like, I think a lot of people like the what's in the bag stuff. Why don't you run through the top of it? Just, I know you have it. You sent me a text, I believe.
I did. You know, I'll pull it right here because I basically, we were kind of trying to track down some stuff for both JT and Rick. And this was as of October on the Ricky Fowler Tracker Twitter account. And so this was updated as of October 1st. And this is just top of the bag. So he still has that Cobra Dark Speed low spin model. I think it's a 9-degree driver that maybe he has adjusted up to 10 degrees. But it's that TaylorMade burner 13.5-degree mini driver that, according to this tweet, he has dialed down to 12.75 degrees that he's got in the bag, in addition to his 5-wood, a 17.5-degree Cobra limited.
He's
XLS,
always been
something like
he's
that.
He's always been a good 5-wood player.
Yeah,
it's the next club of foreign.
You know, it only shows his woods on this tweet I have, so I don't have the full what's in the bag. But I just thought, I mean, a lot of guys, it seems to me, that's the kind of, in the same way that the Jailbird was the trend last year, it's like you see a lot of guys going to this mini driver, taking the 3-wood out, and it feels like a good option. I mean, these guys are obviously skilled enough to hit it off the deck when they need to in the fairway, but they're so rarely doing that given their length that having a sort of an off-speed pitch off the tee seems to be a really, really smart play.
Well, when I think about these clubs, like the mini driver and how you're able to use it in play. So the biggest issue now for players is that the 3-wood goes too far and that the 3-wood and the driver basically morph into the same club. So you see a lot of guys that don't even carry 3-woods. Their next club goes from driver to a 4-wood or a 5-wood because these 3-woods they're just too hot. So why then would a player put in something that's even hotter? A two wood, something with less loft. The reason why, I think, is a driver, in the way these clubs are built now, it's so difficult to be able to control trajectory and be able to control shot shapes. There's very few players in the world that are able, from my eye, from what I watch week to week, that are able to change trajectories with the driver and also change curves both directions. Rory McIlroy is one of the few guys that I can see that can bring the driver up, bring the driver down, and then hit it both ways. He's the best driver of the golf ball in the world. And I would say that the mini driver, I've never hit it, but I know what it looks like. I've set it in my hands. And from what I can tell, it's a club that's obviously going to fly, you know, that 260 to 280, depending on how short or long of a player you are. But I think what it allows you to do, it's first off, I think many guys that are nervous off of a tee and need to find a fairway with a driver, they're going to tee it down. So when you go to that smaller head and you tee this mini driver down, what it allows you to do is it allows you to not get underneath drivers. It allows you to stay on top of it. So when it comes to hitting fairways and being accurate, when guys get really off, for the most part, they get underneath and their arms aren't matched up with their pivot. There's a stall. And then a lot of times there's just, you know, either gets flipped or it doesn't get flipped and you miss the center of the face. With this club, you can swing it probably more like an iron and have to swing less up on it because it's giving you just a little bit of that loft with that 12.5, and it's not going to come out flat and low. It's going to be something that's, you're not going to be hitting into par fives or you're not going to be hitting it into a par three because it's too long, but it's a way in which you can go and swing like you're swinging it on the range. So a range swing, and it comes out the right ball flight, and you can probably change trajectories and change shot shape a little bit with it.
That's truly fascinating stuff, Smiley. For all the golf sickos out there, all the amateurs out there that are trying to get tour level insight on what, you know, everyone wants to buy the fanciest new tech, but like to actually hear you explain the way your swing can change, the way your trajectory can change, you know, what you're trying to do that can maybe mirror a swing you're more comfortable with, an iron with the, you know, but using a driver head or something similar to it. Really interesting stuff. Also, I got my guy Gary back in the comments saying the Lab Adam Scott head is releasing next month. So I'm going to, if anyone Lab is out there listening to this at 9:22 p.m., I'm always here to test.
Well, one other thing too, Charlie, when it comes to that mini driver, just, I don't know if it's anybody else makes it. For the most part, that's the club that they'll put in their bag to be able to turn it over right to left. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times players are more concerned about losing shots to the left with their three wood. Mm-hmm. And so that's another thing, right? Like you have a mini driver now that you can try to take left out of play. And a three wood, for the most part, if you do, you know, it's a dog left hole like Bay Hill at number six, for example. And if you have the mini driver out, you know, you just have that extra couple yards because of the loft. And then the three wood will typically have that extra right to left in it. So it's basically what it's doing. It's giving you that second shot for a driver without having to manipulate anything, because when I played my best on tour, I had two shots with my driver. I had a teed down version and I had a teed up version. There were two different golf swings. Now you have an option to put another club in your bag and you don't have to change what you want to do with your driver. You can build that driver into being a long weapon. And then you have that, the utility, or basically it's you can almost call it a utility club or something that would just be use a couple times around, but you know you can build it for these specific shots.
It's fascinating. It's really, really cool stuff. And I think I'm going to have to buy a mini driver. I've been debating it for a while. I think I got to get a mini driver. You're talking me into it. The other part of the conversation that we kind of teed up here, JT, Breck Cherry asking, you know, was this a, I don't want to say a one-off, but did JT's shot shape or eye fit this course better than others, or are we really looking at a trend line for him that he's going to carry into next season?
I don't know. What do you like? Just when you saw that golf course, in my mind, I didn't see it as like a perfect JT fit with the dog legs. But every time on Sunday, he obviously struck it incredibly well. He just putted. He was 66th in putting in fourth round. We saw PGA Tour post the video of him missing all those putts, but dude, he was stepping up with driver on these dog leg holes and just hitting these perfect seeds right down the middle. Like these balls weren't even landing in the rough. So he's obviously comfortable with his golf swing. And if it weren't for the majors, I think we'd be talking more about, man, how well JT's playing and how close he really is. But, you know, the putter's still the bugaboo, right?
The putter's the putter. And it's actually, and this is again, you know, looking at just sort of trends and paying attention to what he's doing, not, you know, because I feel like we fall victim to that, especially as dads with kids and things going on. I mean, you're working a lot of these events, but it's tough to kind of watch the full coverage of these golf tournaments. And so oftentimes we get to the end and we're trying to consume sort of a synthesized set of data and draw conclusions from that. And too often, I think how a guy actually played gets lost in that sauce, so to speak. And so JT, I saw him putt really well towards the end of the summer, you know, a round or two, and then would kind of get off the tracks toward the end of the tournament. And then what was a trending towards a good putting performance gets lost in the sort of the story of the full thing. And that was the same this week. He had three positive putting rounds and then loses close to two strokes putting on Sunday and loses the tournament by a shot. And I think for him, this was the same song we were singing last year with Colin Morikawa at Zozo. It was like, he's been one of the best ball strikers on earth. You know, he had one little off year after he won a couple majors, but got it fixed. And it was just really the putting he had to figure out. And then he gets with Stephen Sweeney He gets in a more comfortable place. And he goes out and plays as good as you can play this last year without taking home a trophy. And I think that's going to carry into next year as well. I think we're in a very similar place with JT now. And I'm not saying he has to go out and find, I'm not saying, you know, he has to go work with someone specific. He has all that figured out in his camp. But I think he's getting so close on the putting. And if he can just get to a comfortable place, I think we could see him have a year just like Colin in 2025, which is to say a top 10, top five player on tour this next year. Because it's just figuring out that one thing.
Oh, I think you're going to see it. And I've been saying this for a while now about JT for next year. I just think when you miss one of these teams and don't get picked, first off, that's almost like the motivation that you needed as a player to be like, you know what? I need to look myself in the mirror, right? And this is, I think this is what Justin did this offseason. From what I have seen, how much work he has put in this fall. I mean, I don't think people realize how hard these guys work and how hard a guy like Justin works to want to get back, to want to be, you know, what to being one of the best players in the world. I think he's motivated by a multitude of things. I think he knows he can still be a top 10 player in the world. I think he knows that he should be an automatic qualifier on points every year for these cup teams. But I also think that, you know, I think the guys that he's motivated by, right? Like I think Scottie Scheffler, what he's done, for instance, off the tee this year, just seeing that, hey, you know, Scottie Scheffler was a really great ball striker, but he said this on our podcast when I was at his house, and he said, you know, one of the things that people don't realize about Scottie is how long he hits it, but how straight and accurate he is off the tee. So if JT, what he needs is to find a couple more fairways around, he's always had the speed, but it's the one miss that comes out that just doesn't make sense. And it's like, where did that come from? Mm. That's the shot he needs to eliminate, but also then find a couple more fairways around. And then his iron games, dude, that's his bread and butter. So I think he's going to have a huge bounce back year this year. You know,
does he talk to you about putting much? And I'm not asking you to share anything you're not comfortable sharing in this space, but do you have, I remember on the podcast talking about Scottie off the tee, you know where his headspace is, being one of the best on the planet striking the ball. Do you have any conversations with him about putting?
Yeah, no, I've talked to him a bit this year just about his putting, and nothing other than just, you know, how's it going? How's it feel? What's it look like? And I know he started working with Marcus Potter. I'm not sure if he's still working with him or not. I assume they are, but if I know just enough to see that I think what Justin was wanting to find and a teacher is somebody that can make sure that technically everything's right, and then just try to help him improve and just make him feel comfortable, because you could see he's been fighting his setup. He's been fighting just getting comfortable over the golf ball. Which then, for anybody that's ever putted poorly, when you're thinking and your eyes are very active, it's hard to be a good putter because you lose all your feel, that touch of just what you need inside of just where it's going into the hole, how hard to hit it. When you're thinking about how to do all those things, and you throw in two, you know, when you're that are breaking 3 feet, that's touch and feel, and it's dang near impossible to make putts when you're thinking about how to start it online. And I think he's been through a period of that in his career. Now I think he's on the way outside of that, because if you saw his strokes, over the last year, you could see that he's rapidly improving the stroke. And it's just a couple of those rounds, like the Open Championship this year, where everything was going in. And it's like that 30 footer, the Scottish Open too, the week before that, he just had these rounds where he's making everything. You're like, that's what he needs. So more rounds like that. I know he's probably kicking himself for not making one or two extra putts on Sunday, but I think there's so much in front of Justin this year. I really do think that, you know, when I look ahead at the major calendar, that a place like Oakmont just seems like that would be a really nice fit for him. Quail Hollow, going back to where he won the PGA Championship. And then the Open at Royal Port Rush, like that's a golf course that I know he really likes. So I think this major season should set up better, maybe than last major season. And Dude, he was a great major player for a long time. So I think he needs to get back into knowing, hey, I could do this. I can play majors. This is what I'm built for. And I think he's going to get back to more of that attitude, that swagger that he kind of can carry himself with, of kind of Tiger-like.
Well, it's good to see both JT and Ricky near the top of that leaderboard. And I'm sure you're seeing a few down here scrolling that are worth talking about. I think maybe Smiley, as where we are in this episode, I'd love to have a fuller discussion about, you know, a Max Homa, especially on the heels of a really great conversation we had with Keith Stewart this past week of Read the Line. If you like to bet golf and you want some insight on process, go back to our YouTube and watch that episode with Keith Stewart.
It was so good.
I thought it was just phenomenal hearing how detail oriented he is and the way he goes about avoiding the pitfalls and sucker odds. You know, the odds are like sucker pins. I thought it was really, really cool. But I thought it was interesting the way he wrapped that episode of the guys he has his eyes on, and looking at, you know, like a Max Homa this week, where it wasn't terrible off the tee, which has been the Achilles heel for him, you know, the better part of this year, but it wasn't like, you know, near the top of the field in an event where it really he could have showed you something. So I don't know if you have passing thoughts on Max here, if you want to kind of shift over to some stuff that you and I were talking about before the show with regard to tour card, changing of tour cards in 2026.
Yeah, I definitely want to get into that. And the other event I want to talk about just very briefly is give a shout out to Ben On for the driver off the deck that he hit. Love that. Tom Kim almost won the golf tournament. So shout out to Tom. He's been on the show. We definitely want to get Ben on at some point. But that was pretty cool winning the DP World Tour. And again, I know this is a Korean tour event, but I something about the DP World Tour, I can't get it out of my brain. And in the fall, like I think the PGA Tour needs to find a way. It's they're already in business with the DP World Tour.
Yes.
If we get to a schedule, which I know we're about to get into a pretty grand discussion on PGA Tour playing criteria, but a grander conversation about how it all fits in the grand scheme of the world in golf. And, which you actually talked about right before we got onto this, talking about Xander Schauffele. Yes,
that's good, because I want to hit that before we get over to this larger discussion about Camillo. I'm quickly going to throw up yet another Gary comment. Thank you for the shout on Tobacco Row. The reason I'm doing that is simply because Ben On's driver off the deck, almost as good as Smiley Coffin's driver off the deck on the middle there. That was a lot of fun. But to your point, there were comments made. I thought that it was really interesting this last week. Two different sets of comments that were made. And I'm going to paraphrase both of them. The specifics aren't as important. But basically, JT and Xander being over in Japan and being asked about playing over there and just saying, fan support was phenomenal. Was honored to play in front of those fans. Loved being there. Wish we could come here and places like this more often. And then separate from that, Cam Smith was asked about his move to LIV. And he said, it's the best decision I've made in my entire life. It allows me to spend more time in Australia, which is obviously, you know, key for him. And so what we talked about prior to the show was just, we have this discussion numerous times every year when we hear comments like this. It's basically just that we wish that there was more of a global tour presence. Like, the one thing that LIV is doing a really great job of is putting together a global tour, which is attractive, of course, to the best players, not just in the United States, but the best players across the entire world. And so it is no shock to hear a guy like Cam Smith, who is Australian, say, this is awesome. I get to play more often than Australia. I like that. What I did think was interesting is hearing guys that are American, like JT, like Xander, who you'd expect to say, hey, I just prefer to kind of stay here and play the home circuit and take some time off, really have an admiration and enjoyment of playing in Japan. And so I was curious to hear your viewpoint on that. And I know we sketched out kind of in fuller context just the way we like to see a fall swing, so to speak, on the DP World Tour instead of kind of doing these Corn Ferry Tour Plus type of events. So any reflections you had upon hearing comments from JT, Xander, and Cam this past week?
Well, I loved, first off, playing in Japan. I played over there one time. We told
except
a story.
Except for the spiders,
except for the spiders. Right in time for Halloween. But it was a really incredible crowd. It just reminded me of Augusta National and how the patrons at Augusta National were so welcoming to every green and just knew when to clap. And it was unlike any experience I've had as a pro when you get to Augusta National and just how well behaved the crowd is. Maybe it's because they don't have phones, but in Japan, it was like they've never seen a ball go past 160 yards. And at every tee shot that I ever hit in Japan, it was just like, oh, it was like they've never seen a ball go past 160 yards. And they just, every time, even if there had been 20 groups that have come through that day, they're just so shocked that a golf ball could go that far. And so along with that, and then just being really, just knowing when to clap and, yeah. And just, it's not a rowdy crowd. It's a very well-behaved. And I even saw, you know, in some of those larger groups, some people traveling with step chairs. And I thought that was a great pro golf watching move, because yeah. How many times have you stood there and not been able to see anything? This Japan crowd was well ahead of the game and bringing the step chair.
I love that. Yeah. I mean, I think it is interesting examining the societal piece of just appreciating the game of golf. And I don't want to go so far as to critique, like I do think there's a place in the game for your rowdy Bethpage Black type crowds. And I even think that there is, it's just, I guess if we're going to sit here and talk about like game growth, you know, I want to invite everybody to the table and let everyone have a chance to consume the game and play it in the form that suits them. But I do think that sometimes the take of like, I really appreciate the knowledge of the game and knowing when to clap in a more genteel manner, sometimes that gets dismissed as being snooty, when in reality, it's just, no, this culture, the Japanese culture specifically, you know, they really have a love and admiration and appreciation for this game at like a core, like sort of spiritual level. And you see it in the way that, you know, how meaningful Hideki's Masters win was to that entire country. You know what I mean? And I think just things like that, where it's like, I think it's worth celebrating that. And it's worth, you know, to kind of JT and Xander's point, it's worth getting over there more often, you know, and I think it's, that to me is like, if the guys are telling you they want to do it, let's make space in the calendar to do it more than just as sort of a one-off limited field thing at the end of October.
Can I brag a little bit here for a second?
Please. Do you mind? Please.
So when I went over and played in Japan, because I've been a Srixon guy for my entire career, you know, Japan being Hideki, Matsuyama, and Srixon, you know, a majority of that Srixon is what people play over there, which you should too. But when I got there, and this is like on Wednesday, where I don't think crowds are allowed until Wednesday, but I get out there and I could not believe how many fans were coming up to me trying to get an autograph. I'm like,
wow.
It's like, me? What's going on? Like, is this just because like I'm American and like this is, you know, I won the Shriners. I know it is the fifth major, but like, which RIP Shriners
That was another one of the topics that's getting lost in the rundown tonight. Shriners no longer the title sponsor. Do you want to mourn the loss? I mean, it's.
I just this is a whole nother discussion, and it's. I know there's been a sense of there's plenty of sponsors that are going to continue to step up into the ones that do leave. The Wells Fargo's will leave. Truist comes right in.
Truist, yeah.
It's, you know,
we had Cognizant come in for Honda, you know, in the past, you know, year or so.
And, maybe there will always be a sponsor that'll be able to come in and step in and pay the money. But you have to wonder and question, you know, just. I'll say that the fields that a Shriners used to get were, you know, now what they are, it used to be marginally better. Now, was it amazing fields? No, but they would be able to have, you know, 5-6, you know, pretty solid players that would draw crowds. Now it's like, okay, who's fighting for the top 125, right? And who wants to come play? It's just a different deal now. And that's a whole nother thing that we can get into later. But right. I definitely wanted to talk to you about the Cam Smith thing.
Yeah.
Because I know you mentioned it. And Cam Smith's really happy on LIV. Why wouldn't he be? Like, you know, he has the golden ticket, right? Like,
right.
Aussie guy, doesn't like playing golf full time. Like, he's a he's
Fisher, a, loves fishing.
He loves fishing. Like, loves, I don't think beers. He loved the grind of the PGA Tour. And yes, it's a grind. Like, I think some players don't like playing 25 weeks a year. And I think Cam Smith's a guy that's cool with just playing, you know, 14 live events, four majors, a couple Aussie Opens, and calling it a year. And $100 helps that, right? Like, I think this is, you know, without the Saudis throwing $100 million at him and all this, which I'm not sure if that's what he got paid. But, yeah, why wouldn't he be happy, right? Like, it's who am I to say that this man's bank account isn't incredible and that he gets to go home to Australia more? Like, dude, the guy's crushing it. Like, good for him. And who am I to say that it wasn't the right decision for Cam Smith?
Well, and I think it's like I don't think you're minimizing the decision. I think a lot of people just minimize a lot of these live players' decisions to like, oh, of course they took money good. That's why they did it. It's nothing else. Like, I don't hear you minimizing his decision to that at all. I think obviously that's a big part of it. Like, everything becomes easier when you have more money, but I do think that. And it kind of goes hand in hand with the discussion we're having about differences in crowds, differences in you know, the type of people who come and love the game of golf. One of the cool things about our game is that, especially at the professional levels, you have this cast of very unique and different characters. You know, you have, you know, quirky guys like Victor Hovland that are, you know, fascinated about like ancient history and, you know, or like you have the whole spread of different types of guys at various levels. Some guys are grinders. Some guys want to be on the range all day long. Some guys like Cam like to go fishing and have this unbelievable natural talent, can putt the ball, you know, as good as anyone on planet Earth, and just want to kind of chill a little bit more. I think that to the extent that we can create space for all of them, the game is better at the top professional level. And so I'm not applauding. I'm not saying like live is the way or this or that, but I think that's why I like the global piece of it, is that I also think some of these eccentricities, again, as we're talking about with Japanese fans, are aligned with cultural differences. And so creating space to go to different places and say, hey, maybe you're a little homesick or you don't get to spend as much time over here. Like, let's do stuff for you so you feel like it's worth being part of this larger tour that is the best tour in the world. And so for Cam, of course the money makes it easier, but I also think it's like, it's pretty dang cool to be able to kind of do what he does and hang out at home, you know, and the tour wasn't doing a lot of that for him.
And the things are going to continue to change a little bit from that aspect. I think when it started getting rolling with the LIV Golf Tour, I think these players didn't really know what they were signing up for. Like, for instance, for a PGA Tour player, as an independent contractor, I have the ability to plan my schedule, pick what events I want to play in. The PGA Tour can't make me play in anything. LIV Golf Tour, as we know, when you sign the contract, like, you are playing every single week. But then the other part of it, too, is let's say LIV Golf says, hey, Cam Smith, we want you to go and meet with this client, or there's you can't say no. Like, there's certain things that these players, where they could have said no before, LIV Golf can say, hey, we need you up at this event. This is part of your contract. And there's days built in that LIV Golf can use as service days to, whether it's clients that they're trying to do business with, or other things, for LIV Golf promotion, they're able to use them in that facet. So I think that's another aspect that some of these players have been surprised by, just about how they're able to manage their time. And then, you know, it's like, hey, Cam, we need you in New York to come and play in an 18-hole deal. It's like, well, can I say no? You don't have an option to. Like, that's where...
It's like my kid's graduation, my kid's birthday. It's like,
remember,
you know,
Brooks's wife was having a baby and like had to play the next week, finished last at Greenbrier. And you're like, you know, like he wouldn't have played for a month on the tour. Yeah. He wouldn't have played for another month on the tour.
Yeah. No, it's definitely the part of the whole live deal that people talk about probably not enough. But it's whatever you want to take. It's like, you know, going to regular school versus going to year round school. You know, it's like, oh, we get all these like random weeks off here and there. It's like, yeah, but you're showing up to school in the middle of June and July and I'm like off at the beach hanging out with my family, you know, to each their own. Before we switch over to Camillo, Smiley, comment from Marcus Rainwater here. You a sushi guy? Did you dabble in the sushi when you were over in Japan?
Still one of the best meals I've ever had was in Miyazaki, Japan. Justin and I went to an incredible dinner, and Tiger was also played in the same event back in the early 2000s. And the owner of the restaurant had told us that Tiger had eaten there and how much food he ate. And I guess Justin had asked him about the restaurant that we were going to, and he said it was incredible. And of course it was. But it was these little grilled cheese, and then they had the most insane Wagyu beef that just was out of this world. Some of the best steak I've ever put in my mouth. It was like butter, man. Still dream about that grilled cheese Wagyu steak situation, man. The food in Japan, we're hibachi guys, you and I.
Big backyard hibachi guys.
But go do hibachi in Japan, and then you realize it's like, okay, that all the sauces. Yeah, see, I don't have all the, we don't have all the sauces laid out. When do we get to throw the shrimp tail at you? You know,
is there going to be a volcano tonight? Yes. I was told you were going to light a volcano on fire.
Is there not a sake squirt gun?
Yeah. If you're not walking through that gate with a super soaker full of sake, you can just turn right around and go back out. That's
and if it's chilled at all, like, I want you to go stick that sake in the microwave. No. Yes. I want it to be bubbling as it comes out of the super soaker.
Yes. Yeah, that was golly. It's a story that maybe I'll share at some point in the show, but remember, guests, backyard hibachi. A little bit of this action. Yeah. Loving it. That was not where I thought we were going to end when the prompt was the best place you ate when you were playing in Japan, but a good detour nonetheless. So let's see here. Let's finish up with, you know, as we kind of mentioned this, these proposed, I guess best put, it's Camilo Villegas wrote a letter. He is the PAC chairman. And there was a meeting at Shriners, met with some of the players, and wrote a letter kind of explaining some proposed, you know, tour card changes that could be coming in 2026. And so essentially, I'm quoting from two places. There's a Sports Business Journal report. And what I'm first going to read is like some of the reporting around what the changes are. And then I'm going to read some excerpts of Camilo's letter. So they're proposing eliminating 10 Korn Ferry Tour graduate cards, which I found interesting on the heels of our conversation with James Nitties. We were talking about some of these guys and how they're able to get eligible for certain things, and maybe there are too many of these things they're handing out. Cutting the number of tour cards, PGA Tour cards, from 125 to 100. So all of a sudden the fall gets really compelling and really interesting because that number is a lot tighter. And getting rid of 2 sponsor exemptions per tournament, among some other adjustments. In addition to that, the report cited some sources that are saying that the field sizes for these full field events that we've been accustomed to seeing in the 144 to 156 range would move as low as 120. And so I'm gonna just pull kind of the section. So Camilo just talks about the PAC met. We talked to the policy board. We've talked to various leadership on tour, and they agree that we need to kind of move forward with the proposal. And so he highlights those 3 main sections. One is playing privileges. We look to redefine what it means to have a PGA Tour card, and when you earn that card, how that translates to certainty of schedule. The second category, pace of play, focused on determining the right number of players on the course to promote flow of play and to finish the competition on schedule each day. And the third section being point system based on feedback from the membership. We evaluated the middle of the points distribution curve to be more equitable based on performance. And so obviously
we're not economics guys. We're not. if you say something increases and something else decreases, I say
supply and demand.
Yes. And I say none of the above.
Yeah, I just read the letters. I don't know necessarily what they mean. We bring on experts for those types of things. But of course, like, cards are set for 25. None of this is happening until 26 at the earliest. But Smiley, I mean, it's a broad prompt to say to reflect on all of it. But I guess the thing I found interesting in reading this letter is so many of these things you specifically talked about before. You've talked about there are too many cards. You've talked about, you know, pace of play being bad at times. And so going from 44, 56 down to 120, that could be a huge help there. And you talked about the point system where we compared, we talked about in the context of wow, you get so much more for a 10th or 15th at a signature event than you do for like a fourth at a full field event or regular event. So just maybe just reflect on a larger scale to what Camilo's proposing, what the PAC's proposing, and then we can kind of get into some of the specifics to close the show out.
Yeah, definitely go and read the full letter. It's the Sports Business Journal. You can just probably Google Sports Business Journal, Camilo Villegas, letter to players to find it. And the reason why I want you to go read it for yourself is you need to look at Camilo's signature. It's the best signature in the game. I haven't stopped staring at how pure it is. It's as good as it gets. So definitely go check that out and as well read the letter for yourself, because point three, I still haven't really grasped exactly the point system. Based on feedback from the membership, we evaluated the middle of the points distribution curve to be more equitable based on performance. I still don't know what that means. We'll have to break that down. I'll have to ask somebody just to get a little bit more feedback on exactly what that means. But the playing privileges I can definitely speak to, and the pace of play, as I think the biggest issue right now that the tour has is just an identity issue with events. I think signature events and open events and even fall events, and it trickles all the way down to the Korn Ferry of when a player has a card, where do they fit in this just huge system of different levels that the PGA Tour has? And what they're trying to do is get it to where when you do get a PGA Tour card, not only does the player know what they're going to be playing in, but the fans now know where they're going to see these players and what they're going to be competing in. So I think that will help. Not pace of play. It's not going to help these guys hit a golf shot faster, but it may help them space out the tee times a little bit more to where they're not waiting quite as much. So a normal spacing of a tee time would say, let's say it's 11 minutes. Maybe they have an opportunity to stretch it to 13 minutes in this system, or let's say it's 9 and now they can get it to 12. So it does make a difference when we talk about the back half of waves and just finishing, in the springtime before daylight saving switches. And even Shriners, like the rule staff was like, we never can finish this event because there's too many guys playing. It's like, well, I mean, that's something that the PGA Tour should never have a problem with. It. They should know. It's like, hey, there should only be 110 guys playing in this event, because that's the amount of guys that can actually finish Thursday and Friday rounds. So that to me would make a lot of sense, but it just goes into what we've been saying, which is a stronger top PGA Tour of 100 guys makes for a stronger golf environment as we trickle down. And in this environment we're in right now, too many guys are having to make decisions to have to commit to multiple tours, where now they can be like, you know what? I don't have a tour card. I'm playing here. If I have a tour card, I'm playing here, and I'm going to get X amount of starts.
Yeah, I think to me it makes it mean something. You know, it's not
what do you
like
mean? Just like when you say that, like the like having a card making me.
Instead of, I mean, it's just really piggybacking on everything you said. It's like if I'm one of 30 Korn Ferry Tour graduates, and I know some of the categories are slightly different, but you know, it's like if I'm one of 30 Korn Ferry Tour graduates and I think I'm earning
that
PGA Tour card,
gotcha,
and all of a sudden I'm like, I can't get a start for, you know, a couple months, and I'm like, what does this even mean? What did I even do this for? And now I'm behind the eight ball for the rest of the year. I got to play insanely good. And if I don't, I'm just heading right back down to the Korn Ferry Tour, do it all over again. And I think same thing at, you know, 100, cause I think it's then if you're cutting down on Korn Ferry Tour cards, the next question is, are we just kind of keeping the guys who are here on tour longer? Well, if you're cutting from 125 to 100, you're not doing that either. So you're cutting guys out who just for whatever reason couldn't hack it that year. They can of course go back to the Korn Ferry and try to earn their card that way, but you're cutting those guys out. You're bringing in a group of guys from the Korn Ferry Tour who have earned their graduation and now are going to get actual starts instead of wondering what opportunities they're going to get. And I think just from a television perspective, from a product perspective, you know, if you tell me the television window can be shorter now because there are less guys playing in these full field events, and of course even shorter for limited field or, you know, no cut signature events. And so I can tune in and watch all of that, know I'm going to be watching impactful golf the entire time. That's a win as a fan or a consumer, I think. I mean, I just think that there's, you know, It's you want to have the cool stories and you want to have, you know, room for kind of the Cinderella aspect of this whole thing. But I think you can still achieve that with what's being proposed. So I think this is really, I think this is a really good proposal.
Okay. Let's look at it right now. So let's look at the top 100 guys on the PGA Tour and you can look, you can handpick, you know, from 90 to 110 of guys that would be on the outside. Like, so when you finish outside the top 100, one of the things that making for a stronger PGA Tour will do in 100 cards, well, every year, one bad year, you're, doesn't matter who you are, and you've heard Wyndham Clark say this, you're heading back to the Korn Ferry Tour.
Yeah.
And I wonder with guys when they have a year in which they do win and they have that extra year exemption, it's going to mean more because when you're not subject to the top 100 shuffle, that is, I mean, it just, it seems like that would make guys a little bit more emotional about winning on the PGA Tour, which they do, but it would just, I think, have a bigger impact.
What I think too, that there could be a knock-on effect of this where if you're a true golf sicko, if all of a sudden the Korn Ferry Tour is populated with more names you have a familiarity with from the tour because they got bounced from the previous year. Like, I'll say it this way. I tuned in for a lot of Korn. I mean, I was going to anyway, of course, for the job and everything, but because I'm a sicko, but like, it was compelling to have Harry Higgs and a lot of Korn Ferry Tour events this last year where I'd seen him play on tour. I love his personality. I found him interesting, engaging, entertaining. When he was near the top of the leaderboard, I was like, I need to go watch the highlights, figure out a way to kind of consume that tournament because I'm interested in him specifically. And I know him more than the rest of those guys. And so looking at this list right now, if this year was a top 100 cutoff and you got a guy like Joel Damon at 124 that a lot of people are invested in via Netflix Full Swing and a number of other, you know, cool things he's done, you know, on, but also off the golf course, I think that maybe you drum up more interest for that secondary tour. If it's not just like, you know, if we aren't already bemoaning how many guys there are on the PGA Tour, if it's really kept tight and it means something, but also those guys are being knocked down at a level where you're like, okay, yeah, there are a bunch of guys I know on this tour. I want to tune in and watch that as well. That could be a good thing for the Korn Ferry Tour.
Yeah, I think this is a larger discussion too with the Korn Ferry Tour that we talked about with James Nitti's, that whole tour and the golf courses have,
yes,
maybe 25% of the courses that they play really are tour-like. The other 75 are too short, not necessarily a great PGA Tour test, but that's a larger discussion. My big thing is like you said, it does need to mean more when you get that card. And I think it starts right in the fall. The Korn Ferry Tour should finish right when the Scotty Scheffler or whoever wins the FedEx Cup. That event, the Korn Ferry Tour should end right around the same time. And when the FedEx Cup fall gets going, these Korn Ferry Tour guys, the 20 now that would be cut down from 30, need to be playing the FedEx Cup fall with the guys that are fighting for their card. But we are mixing and sprinkling in the new wave of talent to give me something to learn about these new players. Give me a whole fall to learn about these new guys if I'm a viewer. But then you could also watch the storylines, of which I think is very enticing, watching these players kind of fight for their cards who didn't maybe have as many playing opportunities throughout the year with all the, you know, signature events and how tough it is. But it makes for a very competitive fall when you go from top 125 to now top 100, or I don't know how they're going to. Now the fall makes no sense. Like, what are they going to do in the fall? Because is it because it was 50 guys that you're secured, 70 guys make the playoffs. Now you have, oh gosh, it becomes a much more competitive, like way competitive.
Oh
fall.
Yeah. I think to me, I mean, I hear what you're saying and why you're saying it, but I think it makes a lot more sense to me. Like, I think that, you know, it's, of course, yeah, you play the fall, you can get into that next 10 category, you can kind of position yourself for success the following year. But largely, I still, you know, giving all the big names a reason to opt out of playing in the fall only made it less compelling for me. And again, is being watched from the perspective of golf sickos who are trying to kind of figure out
DP World Tour. But don't lose that. Let's not lose sight of that.
Well, that, and that's what I mean. I think there are a number of different ways you can approach this. Like if you're saying Charlie and Smiley, like what's your favorite options on the table? It's we finish up in Atlanta and we go right over to Europe and we just tour Europe and we hit all these cool locales and you know, dramatic settings and the Swiss Alps and things like that. And we go do that. And okay, yeah, we have, you know, our Ryder Cup and our President's Cup mixed in there. But, you know, do that. Maybe mix in your Zurich Classic team event to prep for the Ryder Cup or the President's Cup. You know, that's my long crusade, is to get the Zurich Classic moved to the fall. But do more of that than doing all these kind of lower leverage fall events. But if you're saying, okay, well, the tour is kind of looking out for its own interests and the things it manages. And of course, they have a strategic alliance with the DP World Tour, but that's not their property. How can you fix the domestic product? This feels a lot closer to fixed, to where now I'm tuning in and it's, you know, theoretically, I mean, of course, some big names are going to play at fall events, but you're saying that there are, you know, 51 through 100 that are in, and you still have to fill these fall fields up to, let's say, 120 max per Camillo's letter. I mean, that's 80 guys in those fields, right? Or no, I guess that's, you know, 70 guys in those fields that are playing every week who are not going to earn their tour card the next year. And maybe even more than that, if you consider that you're mixing in 20 Korn Ferry Tour guys. So, you know, you take them from 50, so it is 70. It's like only 30 guys that played on the tour the year before are going to retain their membership the following year. All of a sudden, that's much higher leverage golf to me than like,
it gets
kind of whatever, you know.
The FedEx Cup fall would get so cutthroat. My gosh, when you talk about going from 125 to top 100, it's the amount of cards that are available that just completely changes. So if you finish the year at, you know, 71st and you just missed out on the playoffs, like, you know, you didn't have to do anything because for the most part, you can go try to get the next 10 category, but you're not dropping outside the top 125. But is there a world in which you would drop outside the top 100? Maybe not, but it, I guarantee the guy at 80th is going to be playing because it's easy to drop outside the top 100 probably over a 6 or 7 week stretch. So maybe there is something there with the FedEx Cup fall, because I've
kind of gone back and forth. Memphis is going to get pretty compelling too. Like guys that are like, please let me finish top 50 so I don't have to go play the fall schedule. I mean, 51, I mean, that's a tough scene if you miss that top 50 there on both sides of it.
I still feel like that all needs to get sorted out with top 50. It seems like to me, if you make the playoffs, you should be in the signature events. Like it's kind of weird to me. Like I've never really understood, like, okay, you made the playoffs, but the next week's actually the more important one because that's the one that gets you into signature events. To me, if in a perfect world, when you have 100 guys that are going to be playing, or how many guys are playing signature events, if you make the playoffs in the top 70, you should be in the signature event. So that should be the reward for making the playoffs. And now you go play in a really fun format in the playoffs to hopefully then crown the postseason champion, if you will.
Yeah, I think, you know, and it's fair. And again, I think that while we offer all our suggestions and our preferred solution is going to play DP World Tour and really leaning into that partnership, it does feel like, I feel like we've been fair on the show throughout. Like we're giving the tour room to continue moving towards something that makes more sense. And this makes more sense than the previous iteration of this. So
we need
to
have like one episode in which we just outlined the entire Charlie Smiley tour, just what it should look like. And even including Liv, like trying to figure out if we're throwing Liv in here, how these guys get incorporated. Cause we talk about it every other episode. And if you've listened to a handful of them, you probably heard a couple of the takes, but it would be nice to put it all on pen and paper and do it for one entire episode.
It has to be in person. And, you know, maybe, you know, crack open some you know, beverages or a nice bottle of wine.
Cold brew.
And it's got to be cold brew. And it's got to be Jackson at like a you know, bulletin board or a whiteboard.
Yeah.
Just like Charlie and It's Always Sunny with like yarn connecting it all and like draw like yarn. Us just ideating
the yarn guy.
And just Jackson just yarning us of like, this is what the future of pro golf looks like. I think that's a killer in-person episode. We'll get there.
But the one last thing I'll leave you with on this is, so cutting down from 4 to 2 sponsors invites, do you have an opinion on that?
Well, so, and that's another part that I was kind of vague on, because tell me this, Smiley, I know four was the signature event sponsor exemption mm-hmm. number. Does that change for full field events?
Full field events. No, it's 8. There's typically 4, sponsors invites that are restricted and then 4 that are unrestricted. So if you're a member, you're a part of the restricted, and then the 4 go to the unrestricted, which could go to anybody.
So I took that to mean in that letter that we were going from like in your scenario here, going from 8 to 6 for full field, but that they wouldn't be touching the 4 signature events. If they're going from 4 to 2 for signature events, that starts to get very, very interesting.
Because I probably need to read it myself. Where does it say it? I just remember you saying something about how it's going down.
It was, I think it was the 3rd bullet in here, and it was, I've lost that.
Maybe I lost part of the reporting. Too. I definitely heard you say it.
They are definitely proposing cutting down on that. But okay, it was in the upper section where it was the parts that are being reported. But so to me, I think that has to be just full field, not signature. Because think about this: it's like you have the the Genesis. There's the Charlie Sifford Memorial Exemption. I get the name wrong. So I think it's Charlie Sifford. There's that exemption, and then there's Tiger, like mm-hmm. as a tournament host, who both would need sponsor exemptions under that. So then all of a sudden you have this key pivotal historic event on the tour where a guy that isn't top 30 in the world, that isn't next 10, that isn't swing 5, that isn't top 50 from the previous year, who's trying to get a little momentum and carry it into a key part of the schedule. It's like, sorry, we had to give an amateur an exemption. We got to get Tiger exemption, you know, better luck next time out, buddy. Like that to me, I think gets a little tricky. So if they do cut it down, kudos to them. The more cutthroat is more interesting, but I think it's probably just full field.
I'm the one thing I really do like in this is I'm a fan of it all, because I think going from 144 to 156 guys, that's just too many dudes. Like give me 120 when you show up, just feels right. Doesn't matter the time of the year, 120 guys, and then 100 so cards, whatever it is. I think from that standpoint, you can kind of go figure it out.
And, you know, just I feel like it's time to kind of wrap here, but I just had our guy, Jackson Brown. He's there. He's working the board.
Yeah, Jax.
He's got the yarn. He's got all the different colors of yarn. He's going to connect all the dots for us. We're going to get this thing fixed. Well, Smiley, wow, this was longer than I expected it to be tonight. We covered lots.
I didn't think I was going to rant about Brian Kelly for the first 20 minutes of the show, but in LSU football, but that was, if you missed that and you filed into this late, I definitely had to get it all off of my chest. It was a tough loss for my Tigers against the Aggies. And now we're in a playoff eliminator game against Alabama in 2 weeks, which is always wonderful to be in that situation to potentially ruin Alabama's season. But I know how this goes.
Yeah, look, I'm happy for you, man. I'm just glad to not be the guy that's like ranting about his college football team, because I'm past that. I'm just ready for some mayo. Give me to Charlotte. unless you have any final thoughts, Smiley, I think this is where we wrap the episode.
Yeah, man, all good. I already gave a shout out to Ben on for his one of the DP World Tour and then driver off the deck. So that's my big shout out.
Well, here we go. We're going to try to fire the outro again. Last week, we ended up listening to minimal house music, but we'll just say really appreciate everyone hanging out again, participating in the chat. Always fun to have you guys contributing to the show. It makes the show so much better to be able to kind of use some of those topics and spin them off and into discussions. So thanks for hanging out. Hope to do it again soon. Look out for more fun stuff in the feed this week, both the pod feed, YouTube. We got some stuff we're excited about, so we will talk to you on all those locations very soon, and thanks for hanging. See ya.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.